Hello, and welcome everyone to another episode of Young Mash the podcast. Today we have a very special guest, my teacher, someone I picked up all of my neuro coaching tips and tools. It's Mark Robert Waldman, who's based in California, and he's been kind enough to join us for class yesterday. And Tatiana, who you've met before, and Tatiana is going to lead the way and ask all of the questions that you guys have asked and wanted to have answers to.
Thank you very much, Kate, for such a warm welcome. I just again want to thank Professor Waldman and just welcome him to the stage. So in case you didn't know, Mark Robert Waldman is a neuroscience researcher and creator of NeuroWisdom 101. He has lots of best-selling books, but his national bestseller titled How God Changes Your Brain was chosen by Oprah as one of the must-read books for 2012. He travels through the world teaching mindfulness and neuro leadership strategies, and now he is here to teach us. So obviously we've had a few sessions about techniques surrounding neuro coaching, and I think as a group we are all quite familiar with these techniques. But for our listeners and for our audience, people who might not be aware, would you mind just giving a brief summary about what neuro coaching actually is and what it entails?
Neuro coaching evolved out of our brain scan studies when we were looking at what goes on in the brain of a Franciscan nun who is doing Christian centering prayer or focusing on a passage from the Bible, or a Buddhist practitioner who might just be focusing on the notion of pure consciousness. And Andy Newberg also brought in, was actually asked by National Geographic to do studies on Pentecostals speaking in tongues so you could see what was going on in their brain. And for the past 20 years, we've done all types of brain scan studies on Sufis, on atheists who pray to God. Is there a different thing that goes on? And we began to build a template of what is happening in your brain when you're engaged in any form of deeply relaxed contemplative practice? And what began to emerge over the past 20 years is that when you're in that state that I'll call relaxed mindful awareness, you're more present, you're connected with whoever you are speaking with. And we also realize that if you wanted to have the most effective dialogue possible with somebody you care for or somebody who you're having conflict with, then you could basically both sit down and go through a series of brief relaxation strategies that are quite different from what most people would expect. And those would be doing a mindful yawn, because that turns out to be the fastest way to turn down excessive busyness in your thinking and imagination process. And then for your body, what if you were to just do one super slow movement with your head or any other part of your body? And when I mean super slow, you take a full 60 seconds to do that. We realize that the slower you go, the more awareness, which is again associated to that part of the brain that was stimulated through contemplative practices. And on a particular drawing here, it would be that blue area called the salience network. And we began to develop a unique form of dialogue called compassionate communication. Two people sit down, they put themselves into a profound state, relaxed, mindful awareness. So you're kind of in the present moment, you don't have any thoughts particularly going on. And then when an interesting thought or impression kind of floats into consciousness, you share that out loud with the other person who you're facing, whether it be on Zoom or in person. Then you close your eyes for a moment, come back into that relaxed state of mindful awareness. The other person is listening deeply to the brief sentence that you said, because when you're in this relaxed state, sometimes it's actually hard to come up with more than 10 or 20 words, which is perfect because neuroscience shows that the listener can only grab 10 or 20 words at one time if the speaker pauses. That allows you, the listener, to use other parts of your brain to put together the meaning of each of the words that I'm speaking right now. So in this slower, brief dialogue, we found that anyone, pair people up with a stranger, speak a few sentences briefly, come back to a state of relaxed, mindful awareness. The other person listens and responds with a few sentences to what they heard, back into that relaxed state, back and forth and back and forth. In 4 to 7 minutes, most people feel a surprising sense of intimacy, even though they're facing somebody they really don't know. And so that was a lot of the research that we did and we first put it into How God Changes Your Brain. And then we put it into, we focus on that entirely. And that book is called Words Can Change Your Brain. Slowly, we began to realize, and this kind of mindful dialogue goes all the way back to 1993 with a group of psychotherapists, we discovered that you could take two people who are in conflict with each other, who are married, who are considering having a divorce. And if you have them deeply relaxed, use a few mindful yawns, super slow movements and stretches. And then specifically, we ask each one, what is your deepest, innermost value? And if you're in that relaxed state, a particular word will come to you. And we ask them, what is your deepest personal value? And I can exemplify that right now, if you want, by simply saying, hey, Kate and Tatiana, just close your eyes for a moment. Do a yawn and a stretch and relax and forget about everything I've said. And everyone who's watching this video, do the same thing. What I mean by mindful yawn is just pay attention to where that yawn begins, what it feels like as you yawn. And you keep doing this along with just the most pleasurable movements and stretches you can do until you feel like your mind has calmed. Tatiana?
Family.
And for me, peace. Oh. So let's imagine that I am the coach or the therapist at the moment, and that Kate and Tatiana have either a professional conflict with each other, that said something that pushed the other person's buttons, they feel like this, whatever else. Even so what I'm saying is that you can do this with a friend who you're anchor at, and you can even do it with your parent or somebody who you are dating. When you have that conflict, if you can get them to agree to yawn, stretch, relax, focus on a deep inner value, these three values that we have, you then ask the two people who are conflicted with each other, are you willing to speak for the next 20 minutes honoring each other's values? So no matter what it is, most people's values are, you know, could be love, it could be peace, they could be feeling deeply listened to. And I'll give you another example. Close your eyes for a moment and ask yourself, what is your deepest relationship value? What comes to your mind, Tatiana?
What comes to my mind is mutual understanding.
Okay. And Kate?
Connection.
So I would ask, and we're just making the assumption that Tatiana and Kate are having a fight with each other and they're thinking, you know, to heck with this relationship, we'll just move on. You ask each other, are you willing to honor that word or phrase that the other person said? So always there's an agreement in that. So now you, if you're alone, your job is to make sure that you keep relaxing and coming back to that inner value, whether it be peace, connectedness, being deeply listened to. And usually in a conflictual situation, you need a third person. It could be a friend. It doesn't have to be a coach or the therapist, to keep holding that space and making sure that each person only speaks one or two sentences, pauses, goes back into that state. And what happens, because you're staying deeply relaxed, it becomes very difficult to plug into anger or fear or anxiety. And you end up learning how to listen to the other person much more deeply. So that's the key framework of neurocoaching. It's an education system. You're going to teach another person who is wanting to explore a problem that they're having with themselves or with you. Yawning, stretching, sometimes stroking. There are about, you know, six or seven evidence-based strategies that we've discovered helps to stimulate that blue salience network in your brain, which brings you into the present moment. It just stops anxiety and depression and anger and rage from being present. Now that you're both in that state, and you can even do it in a whole group situation, you engage in what we're calling compassionate communication. Simply speak about 10 or 20 words, and if the person tends to speak too much or too fast, but the most cool thing is you select the best word, which we rarely do when we're talking to each other. We just kind of, in an informal conversation, we wander all over the place. And our brain has a very interesting quality, is that it only stays focused to about 10 or 20 words. And then it turns inward, it goes into that imagination default network. And during that time, it's doing its own thing. It's putting together its own meaning and value and purpose, but you're not able to listen to that person over the next 10 or 20 seconds. So the other person's chattering on, and you've gone somewhere else with it. If you interrupt that process and just speak 10 or 20 words, listen deeply, respond to those 10 or 20 words back and forth and back and forth, you can sometimes both end up in a profound state of bliss. Most people learn how to hear each other and listen to each other for the first time. And we teach this to CEOs and COOs, the head people in the corporation, how to sit down and do that among themselves and with their employees and with the team that they're working for. And it's so effective that, you know, they kept me employed as a faculty of the executive MBA program at Loyola Marymount University, specifically to teach these busy executives running multi-million dollar companies how to deeply relax, which makes you more productive, less stressed, and then how to talk in a way that will improve the connection between you and everybody else who's working together to achieve some particular goal. It's that simple.
So something I wanted to explore was kind of the difference between traditional therapy and neurocoaching. So when I first came into this program and before we started the collective and before I had sessions with Kate, I was under the impression that neurocoaching was very similar to like your traditional therapies, your cognitive behavioral therapies, your talking therapies. And I think our audience, you're shaking your head, and I think our audience might think that way. So would you mind explaining the difference between the two? And having said that, do they actually achieve the same outcomes for a particular subset of patients or people?
Let me ask you a question.
Go for it.
And anyone who has ever gone to therapy, what therapist has ever said to you, first of all, I want you to deeply yawn and stretch and relax and anchor yourself in a deep inner value, because it's immediately going to change yourself from the anxiety and desire. You know, you go to see a therapist because there's some problem you can't solve yourself. So the therapist may be deeply relaxed. They may be deeply listening to you, but they let the client or patient talk on and on and on about their problem. Well, it turns out, from a neuroscientific perspective, that the longer you talk about a problem, the more you build a memory that embeds that problem basically into your behavior. So you want, if you're having a problem and you're saying, I don't feel confident and I'm having a problem in school or with a friend of mine, this is, again, how many therapists have you ever met said, hey, I'm interested in hearing what you say, but I want you to count your words and stop after 20, because you both stay in a relaxed state of mindful awareness. Me, the coach or therapist, has suspended my belief system about what I think your problem might be, what I think your solution could be, and what I think mental health is. Oh, there's 500 schools of psychology and coaching out there, at least 50 different total theoretical views. And each one of those people will see you differently, have a notion of what you should do with each other, what exercise, what way of talking to do. And they have their notion of what they consider to be optimal psychological health. Well, they can't all be right, can they? And the answer is no, none of them are right. So whatever theory or belief you have about what problem you have, I want you to understand that prior to Freud, people did not have all the psychological problems that now fill that very thick DSM psychiatric textbook. I mean, if you felt down or blue or unmotivated, there was one word used for it, which goes all the way back to ancient Egyptian times, melancholy. I'm just feeling good. Instead of trying to break depression into, you know, all these different things going. This is a radically different way of working with somebody. It says, throw away all your rules, throw away all your learning as the coach or the therapist. Just stay there in the present moment, listen deeply to what they're saying, one or two sentences at a time, and then respond in a way that, with a couple of sentences that feel really salient to you. And that word salient is definitely related to that salience network. Two of you are now on equal grounds. This person's not talking all the time and just listening. This person isn't just giving it advice and listening. This forces both of you into a profound connection, where together you can hear each other better. And then you can ask the client to use their intuition, that salience network. If they're deeply relaxed, what does your intuition tell you is your real problem? And what might be a genuine solution that comes to you? And in that process, if you're deeply relaxed, a client will have insights, 10, 20, 30 of them in a single hour, in case nodding your head, because we've done that together. And it's like, oh, wow. And I haven't had to tell that person what I think their problem is and what I think they should do about it. Now, after they've done that, and you see their face really light up, you've given them greater autonomy. You've showed them a strategy that they can use the moment they walk out of the office, and you've eliminated the one thing that therapists tend to do is pathologize you. And the one thing, I don't know about you, but for the 20 years that I was in good and bad psychotherapy, I was continually trying to figure out what was wrong with me until I eventually came to the conclusion that there wasn't anything wrong with me. Does that give some kind of a sense of how profoundly different this is?
Definitely. I think the one word that I really want to emphasize there is autonomy. You know, traditional psychotherapies are very much based on kind of this hierarchy between the therapist and the patient. The therapist is there to tell you what to do, what your problem is. The patient is there to just explode and explain all their problems. But what is really nice about neurocoaching is it really emphasizes that mutual empathy that those two people have between each other. And
It builds that mutual empathy.
It does.
That rarely happens in the world in any form of conversation, because nobody's ever taught us how to deeply listen and to speak brief enough so that the other person's brain can comprehend what we mean. In that sense, you have to have face-to-face connection like this. You have to be able to see the person's facial connections and pay specific attention to their tone of voice. And that's what builds neurological empathy.
Yeah. And it's just nice that you don't have to rely on someone, and that, you know, once you've learned the techniques and once you've practiced them, you can just do them anywhere, anytime. Sometimes I'll find myself driving, I'll get a bit, you know, stressed or anxious, and I'll find myself pulling over somewhere, stretching and yawning and rubbing my hands together, because that's what makes me feel comforted and that's what takes me to my deep relaxed state. So it's just really nice that I don't have to, you know, be booked into someone's diary and wait weeks and weeks, because I have the power to, you know, relax myself and to change the way that I think, if that makes sense.
So there have been hundreds of studies done on what makes psychotherapy effective. And the two key elements is, one, the client has to be self-initiating and self-motivating. I've experienced this all the time when, you know, in couples therapy, one person really wants to make their relationship better, but the spouse, even if you drag them into therapy, they don't want to be there. And they may say a few words to Lisa, but they're not motivated to listen or to look at their behavior or to experiment with a different way of talking or interacting. So the unmotivated person doesn't get any benefit from therapy. If you and the other person come in and you're really curious, you know, and want to play, the curiosity and playfulness are two key emotions that nobody recognized until Panksepp came along with his amazing research. You bring curiosity and playfulness in to the creative problem solving device. So in that particular way, the curiosity and playfulness comes from that yellow area, your deep instinctual emotions. But the curiosity is also from that yellow area, and it releases all of this dopamine that goes right up to the top of the head, to that creative imagination part of your brain that's designed to dream up 100 different ways to get whatever that brain wants: more pleasure, more knowledge, more intimacy, more closeness. And then you have to be in that deep state of relaxed, mindful awareness and watch all of those thinking processes that are going on 30 times faster than you ever put into words, and intuitively kind of pull from it what feels the most salient or valuable. That's why that blue area is called the salience network. The moment you stimulate that blue area, it creates an optimal shifting and balance with your imagination, your ability to think and decide and make a choice, and to identify what's personally meaningful to you. And very few therapies even talk about, even ask the client, what do you find to be the most valuable? What gives you the greatest pleasure or satisfaction?
What would you say to somebody who is skeptical of the way neurocoaching works because they've spent years in psychotherapy or traditional therapy? How do you motivate someone to start using neurocoaching techniques?
I would tell them that I'm skeptical of everything I'm saying at the present moment. Why don't we give it an experiential try? Why don't we experiment with this kind of talking, this kind of relaxation, and simply see what happens? So again, it's like, let's throw away all the things we think we know about help, problems, coaching, and therapy. We'll come back into the present moment. And in that present moment, you're stimulating that blue area again, that salience network. And the moment you do that, that is now what is recognized as optimal psychological health. So that's what network neuroscience has created. We can enter a state of optimal psychological health for 10 or 20 seconds at a time at will. It's simply easier to do with somebody else in dialogue. Otherwise, we tend to get caught in our imagination and wander off. So it turns out that anxiety, depression, virtually every psychological problem means that you are spending too much time worrying in your imagination. Whatever you're worrying about isn't something that's happening in the present moment. You're just thinking that, you're just watching that part of the brain that says, maybe something bad will happen. And you're ignoring that part of the brain that says, you know, maybe something wonderful will happen. And you're not letting that salience network intuitively decide what's the best way to avoid failure and to proceed in success to reach whatever goal that you want. And if you do hit a barrier, forget about anything you've ever read in any book about how you get over a problem. That problem is constantly being addressed by the dialogue between the imagination network and your salience network. So what we found is that being in that state of relaxed, mindful awareness is the most profound way to achieve optimal psychological health for at least 20 seconds or several minutes at a time. And then you simply practice this together with somebody, alone, but always the need to teach a friend or a colleague how to do this. And ideally, ideally at least one or twice a week to sit down and spend a full 20 minutes doing this with somebody you trust. You know, they speak a little briefly, relax, may respond or not. And it's in that 20 minutes that everyone continually discovers something new. And there's a reason for that, because that blue area turns out to have von Economo neurons in it, which is your intuitive processing part of your brain. It is the part of your brain that creates empathetic connection with somebody else. And it's the part of the brain where you feel somebody else's suffering or happiness or pleasure. It's your social brain. And it's the last part of your brain to develop. And, you take 20 minutes alone once or twice a day to do some type of meditation. And all of the research all the way up till about, 2005 showed that this is a wonderful thing for your brain. It helps to, lower stress, anxiety, and interrupt most of the psychological problems you have. Our research, our brain scan study showed that, you don't need to meditate for 40 minutes. 20 minutes has the same effect on the brain. Then we did a study that showed 10 minutes has exactly the same effect on the brain. And since that time, many researchers have discovered that you can sit there and maybe focus on the word acceptance. I'm just going to let the problem be there. In that period of time, the problem dissolves. So all we have to do is spend a few seconds, ideally several times an hour, which is why I always have somebody, I usually have a bell that I'll ring over in my other office, to download a mindfulness clock on here. When you hear it ring, do one mindful yawn, one super soul stretch. Now, if everybody does one yawn and stretch right now, and we feel like doing some self-nurturing touch and coming back to the inner value that you hopefully can remember and wrote down, the profound shift in your mental state from 20 seconds ago. I'm back. I can listen now. I don't have to spin out a speech or share what I know. I'm just here. I don't need to say anything else. And now all of us might be in the perfect state to see what happens next between us.
And let's see what does happen next between us. I wanted to touch more on depression and anxiety. Obviously, you said that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of anxiety, and I'm not sure if the same goes for depression, comes from being stuck in that imagination network, always thinking about what if something goes wrong rather than what if something actually goes really, really well, and what if I become really successful and things like that.
All of those thoughts, the what if, that's what that imagination, that huge orange, is designed to do. It's constantly looking at all the things that may go right or wrong in the future if you did A, B, and C, but if you did D, E, and F, you'll have this different kind of outcome. It's the prediction part of your brain. And that's why network neuroscience is revolutionary and transformational. They said, oh, look at this. We can put 10,000 people in the brain scan doing this special thing that creates these giant air ball drawings with all of these interweaving axons throughout the brain. And we can see what's going on in the brain of an anxious person, too much activity up here, what's going on in the brain of a seriously depressed person, too much activity going on up here. And most of the time, the problems that we have, there's poor connectivity between that default imagination network and that salience network that's designed to keep an optimal balance between your conscious decision-making processes and your creative imagination that's there. So these brief moments of relaxed mindful awareness stimulate the salience network. The salience network creates an optimal balance in the brain that's now associated with optimal psychological health. It's a powerful thing to say to yourself, I'm really anxious right now. Oh, that's a fantasy. But I'm sitting here. I'm sure I have a ton of problems that I could focus on, but they're all put aside because I'm going to be here dialoguing with you. That's the importance of having a friend or a colleague, to do this with, or a teacher to show you how to do this with, because when I'm alone and I'm staring out into the distance, your brain is designed, the moment you are alone and you close your eyes, for the default mode network to become profoundly active. You have to learn how to let it be active for 10 or 20 seconds, and then relax, come back into the present moment where it gets a chance to rest. And then you notice, oh, that anxiety has disappeared.
If we learn to engage the salience network by using these techniques, and thus disengage the imagination network that can contribute to the feelings of depression and anxiety, do you think
it's down? You don't disengage from it. You just stop it from being overly active. Yeah.
But do you think it's then possible for someone who has been, clinically diagnosed with depression to get off of their medication or become less reliant?
Well, for mild forms of depression, yes.
Okay.
However, sometimes the neurochemical activity in the brain and the structure of different networks are malformed, or they don't connect right on a physiological level. And that's where that manic depression type of bipolar behavior might not go away. Yes, these medications will dull all of those networks. So in essence, it eliminates your motivation as well. All of the research shows if you add a little bit of mindfulness practice to the to whatever medical treatment you're taking, you heal faster, the drug is more effective, even if it's a placebo. And so I'm not saying, to ignore your doctor or whatever else, but again, how do you know if the antidepressant or the anti, shall we say, ADD drug, by the way, there's no evidence that ADHD, attention, there's no such thing as attention deficit disorder. They cannot find any particular pattern in the brain, and there's not a single medication shown to actually make much of a difference. So again, this is kind of interesting. That young child whose mind is wandering all around the place usually turns out to be gifted. And our educational system has simply said, no, you have to stay focused on what I'm teaching you and nothing else. And I'm saying, let your mind wander. That's why I always say, close your eyes and ask everyone, what have you found to be the most interesting, useful, or valuable in anything that has transpired in the last 40 minutes? So all of you, everyone, close your eyes. Yawn, stretch, relax, as you can't tap in to that intuitive network unless you are relaxed. And ask your intuition, what have you found to be the most interesting, valuable, useful, intriguing in anything that's been discussed so far? And see what your intuition whispers to you. And write it down on a piece of paper. And all you do is sit there and kind of be curious about what may or may not float into consciousness. It could come to you in 10 seconds. It might take 10 minutes. As long as you enjoy being in this state of relaxed mindful awareness, you're in a state of optimal psychological health. But let me show you how unique everybody's insight and discovery is. So, Tatiana, what did your intuition latch on to as being one of the most valuable or important things to ponder?
Probably that a lot of anxiety just comes from being in that imagination network. That was something pretty big for me, and that you can control it by, you know, using the techniques to be in that salience network.
What came into your intuitive mind?
One of the most profound takeaways from the course, and one of the many, is something that goes very much together with my personal values, is that there's so many over-diagnosed people. Suddenly everyone has ADHD, suddenly everyone is anxious, suddenly everyone has depression. And the fact that we now have scientific evidence to demonstrate that that is not the case, I think it's beautiful and hugely reassuring and very freeing. And I absolutely love that.
I agree.
A lot of what you said had nothing to do with any conversation we've had so far. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who are watching, I want you to do it again with me and Kate. Close your eyes and ask for a brand new insight other than the one that you just gave. And share with me what comes to mind. Because you can do this 10 times over.
I'm going to do it using the 10-word technique, so that we're implementing what we've discussed. Mindfulness builds mutual empathy and can encourage beautiful conversations.
Mindfulness done with another person doing mindfulness creates mutual empathy.
That's perfect.
I'm just mentioning that because there's only a few thousand people in the world who have experimented with doing mindfulness or meditation out loud with another person. Kate, what was your second insight?
How listening to the same speech, the same conversation, different brains will pick up what's relevant to them, irrespective of what's being said.
And I'm sure all of you watching this probably came up with something quite different. And if we were all present at one time, and there were like 20 of us, about half of the students come up with something that I didn't say at all. And what I tell my students is that that's more important than anything I actually said, because that was how your brain put together the problems that are unique to your life playing with your memories and past experiences and your unique form of creative imagination, it put it together in a way for you to go out and experiment and explore with. And that's what makes it so beautiful and simple to do with anybody at any time. Even if they don't want to play the game, I'll walk into a room with people who are yelling and I'll just continually go, peace, 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 or bliss. My word for today is bliss. And things that irritate me, bliss, work on the right and back in bliss. And then you're kind of staying 75% in a pleasurable state, observing all the noise going on. And then you teach yourself how to ask your intuition, I wonder what might be the most useful or valuable thing I might say. 9 times out of 10, that's different from anything you would have said, and will have a much deeper effect if the other people choose to listen. So, if you're going to be a neuroscientist, no, you have to learn specifics to do that. That requires repetition. But for everything that's psychological and emotional, that's changing all the time. So there's no such thing as an ideal form of health or an ideal way of thinking. In fact, anytime you try to repeat a behavior, you try to be calm in the same way, you're going to create irritation, because calmness is just a word you selected to describe being in the present moment, and it's never the same present moment. So yes, it can take 20 years to learn that. And that's why I always say, hey, trust your intuition first, play with the ideas I've suggested and the ones that intuitively came to you, share them with a friend or a colleague or a partner. And in my experience of doing this type of practice over the past 12 years, hardly any client needs to come back more than one or two times, maybe three, if they're dealing with an incredibly traumatic, disturbing experience. Because most of our problems is that we're just not grounding ourselves in the present moment, where we can listen to how our brain is uniquely designed to offer the best possible solution to anything we encounter. That's why we have such a huge imagination center, and it's active while you're even in the womb.
I think something that I want to take away from this is, if I just personalize this whole discussion that we've been talking about, as a medical student and someone who is very close to the finishing line of becoming a doctor, and someone who has been through this kind of neurocoaching and these mindfulness techniques myself, I have seen such a massive difference. And I feel like that is something that patients could benefit from as well. You know, you spend so long ordering investigations for patients, prescribing them medications, but you don't actually ever prescribe mindfulness techniques or anything like that. But the impact that it can have on someone is huge. And not only that, but I feel like it's something that should and probably, you know, will be embedded into the curriculum. You know, I feel like it's something that should just be taught in schools. It's something so simple, yet if you're learning from a young age and you have these techniques to equip you for later in life, I think it can really be, you know, life-changing.
We teach this to as many teachers as possible and to faculty members of different colleges, but you have 150 years of the same belief system about what education is. I think it'll take decades, but here's what's beautiful. The things that you said, Tatiana, were just, they gave me wonderful tingles. I didn't teach any of that to you. I presume you got that from Kate, yes?
Here and there.
So look how easy it is for somebody else to pass on these things in their way that that means value to, and you can basically spread that one out. It's kind of like a chain letter. Mm-hmm. So I would hope that everyone who's watching this will experiment with anything that you found intriguing and interesting and share it with 10 other people. And if just two people go, oh, wow, that's interesting, they'll be willing to go out and introduce it to another 10 people. And maybe in a few years, instead of there being a few thousand people doing this, we should have 10,000 people doing this, maybe more. That's an incredible thing. Particularly since all of this stuff is so simple. So that's the most amazing thing. The most complex thing in the world is neuroscience. And what it shows consistently are these very simple little principles. You can only hang on to about 10 or 20 words of what that person says. You know, there are insights inside of you all the time that you've never learned how to access because you've never stimulated your von Economist neurons. But there's one more thing that everyone needs to do. When you're in this state of relaxed mindful awareness of optimal psychological health, you don't form memories. So whenever you come across an insight that makes you go, it's like an aha experience. Oh, wow. Take 20 seconds to savor it. So the other strategy in neurocoaching and in mindfulness is that you observe without judgment all the negative thoughts and feelings that are going on. And then when you have a positive memory or an exciting new insight, to sit with it and savor it. And again, write it down, share it with somebody else. So it does begin to form a memory and a new behavior of going through life, pausing as many times as you want to, observing what's happening inside and outside, and then intuitively asking, what do you find to be the most interesting, valuable in the present moment, and savoring.
I think, Professor Waldman, you've answered my last question very, very well. And my last question, you touched on how only a few thousand people in the world are aware of these techniques, but how can we make this bigger? And the way we can make this bigger is by sharing what we have found with each other, and also to join us on our mission, on our collective. Please do follow us on Instagram, Young Mativ. We have lots more exciting content coming. And I would just like to say, Professor Waldman, on behalf of the whole collective, and also just on behalf of everyone, I'd like to really thank you for joining us on this podcast. I even learned a lot myself through this podcast, and I've been through like loads of sessions myself. I was in your talk yesterday. I've heard it all from Kate as well. But I really, really found it enlightening. And I just wanted to thank you for joining us.
Moment, you stimulate that curiosity and playful part of your brain. And so every time I talk of this, if I'm in the present moment, I say something totally different. Sometimes I have insights of, that feels valuable to share at the moment. So I hope all of you will sit down with a couple of friends and watch this video together. I hope everyone can help to spread it out there. Your organization is fabulous because you're doing what I've always hoped and wished and dreamed would happen, that nonprofit organizations would begin to use social media to share something that's not just brand new, but is evidence-based and brain-based. Neuroscience shows us what's placebo and what really has an effect that can be transformation.
Thank you. We're very, very happy to have you on this journey with us as well. So it couldn't have been done without you. Thank you very much.
I have to chime in, and I have to say that so much of the work that we do is steeped and based so deeply on the research that you and Andy Newberg have done over the years. And it's without the dedication and help of other neurocoaches who are working with me, we wouldn't be where we are. And Tatiana will will attest to this. When the group was started with 3 months ago and the group we have today is an entirely different group of people, you know, the mindset and the levels of inner balance is entirely different. Wouldn't you say, Tatiana?
Absolutely. I got goosebumps as you said that, because it's so true. I wish you could see one of our first sessions. Everyone had cameras off, no one was really engaging, and now it's like we're a little family, and it's just the most beautiful thing to see. It really is.
And the trust has developed between the mentors and the masters and all of us. It really is a group that's come together so beautifully, and we all check in with each other daily. It's not a day that goes by that we're pretty much abreast of everyone's life on a daily basis.
I do want to add one more thing that I love to add at the end of any time I share anything about neuroscience. The opening sentence in our next book to introduce network neuroscience is that what I was to tell you that everything, absolutely everything you think you know about the human brain is 99% wrong. Neuroscience is going through an amazing transformation. And so the thing that I love to say when I'm after, you know, doing a workshop or whatever else, I like to say, oh, and by the way, everything I said to you might not be true. Might be my distortion of that neuroscience. You're going to have to go to PubMed.gov to find out what's happening. And maybe tomorrow, a brand new discovery will be made that will change everything again. Reinvent psychology, reinvent neuroscience, reinvent the whole educational system. When I do that, people usually go, what? Everything you told me might be false? But that's what's so wonderful when you take it in, because that means, hey, trust your intuition. What you found valuable is what your brain is trying to tell you works for it. Not your mind, not your conscious mind, not me, not that guru up on the top of the mountaintop. Tap into that anytime you need some sage advice. And if you're having trouble doing that, just do it with a friend and it becomes so much more easier.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor Waldman.
And thank you so much for the two of you, Tatiana. Thank you for the beautiful questions, some of which I know that you've come up with. Some of them have been sent in. We have plenty more. So, Mark, we'd love to have you again, if you will.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much.